Hey, everybody. Paul Mercurio here. Hope you guys had a good week. My guest this week is a return guest, Yardley Smith, voice of Lisa Simpson on The Simpsons, among other things. We had such a great conversation. It was kind of brief, and we wanted to talk more, and so we did. And we got this really, really kind of detailed chat going. So check it out. Enjoy it. We cover some new ground, a lot of new ground. And also appreciate you guys coming to check out my one-man show. We got shows coming up March 6th, March 13th in New York, Permission to Speak. You can get tickets at telecharge.com. And please leave some nice reviews on iTunes. Okay. Thanks, guys. Welcome to the show. My name is the guy whose name is on the show. And joining me back for another visit is Yardley Smith, the voice of Lisa Simpson and the co-host and co-creator of a really cool podcast called Small Town Dicks. We had such a nice conversation.
We did.
And you were in L.A. I'm in New York, and you came to New York just to see me.
That's right.
Okay. He's such a good liar. Welcome back.
Thank you.
Now, can I ask you a question? Because something popped out of me. Is it true you were born in Paris and your birthday is July 3rd?
That is true.
I proposed to my wife in Paris and we got married on July 3rd.
Shut up.
I'm telling you.
Oh my God.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah.
And I was a nervous wreck when I did it because I had the ring made and then, you know, you got to go through TSA. So I didn't want the ring to set off the alarm. So like, I'm like, I got somehow, I got two people to be between us. I got her ahead of me. It was ridiculous. And then I had to put it in the safe at the hotel. I was a nervous wreck.
It's funny. I don't think I've ever heard a story of a man proposing that where he was like, yeah, it's no big deal. Everything went exactly as planned. No, it's like one of the most harrowing moments in every man's life,
yeah,
it seems.
Exactly. It is just, and then when you do it, it's like that scene in The Godfather, the first one,
yeah,
where Michael's at the table and he goes and gets the gun and the camera's coming in on a single. And his eyes are going back and forth. And his nostrils are flaring and you hear the subway and then he gets up and he shoots him. It's that same feeling, although it's not like murder.
Gosh,
it's not like
I hope
death.
Not.
It's not death. It's the opposite of death. But anyway, it's great to have you. And we're going to talk about Small Town Dicks and The Simpsons and all that good stuff. But, I, you know, when we talked last, I wanted to talk more about you, too, because you have really interesting background and career. And you were your dad wrote for UPI and
yes.
Washington Post.
Mm-hmm.
And was an obituary writer for the Washington Post, which
yes.
is an art in and of itself.
Indeed.
And did you ever think about maybe journalism or going into that field?
Oh, no. No, no. I mean, I wrote a novel, actually, that was published by HarperCollins in 2009.
Mm-hmm.
And that really came out of the fact that one of my first agents I had for 22 years.
Wow, that's a long time.
Really long time and very unusual in our business, as
yeah.
you know. And then after 22 years, I just felt like he was asking me more questions than he had answers for and then certainly I had answers for. And so—
You mean in terms about where to go with your
yeah.
career?
Yeah, and I was like, and I was not getting the auditions to go in front of the camera anymore, like, and I'm by no means lay all the blame at his feet. The business was changing a lot. Movie stars were now like, oh, sure, I'll slum it and do television.
Right.
Well, those of us who made, you know,
you get pushed
right?
down. So my agent had the same conversation with me.
It was.
And just for those listening who aren't familiar with the business, so there was a time when movie stars stayed in movies. TV was considered sort of, you know,
it was like
slumming.
Yeah, slummy.
And then they start, you know, with the advent of Amazon, this, that, and the other, and a number of other things, people start saying, these big movie stars, like, yeah, I'll do some TV. So that means the people that were the A-list people for TV become B and the Bs become Cs,
yes,
et cetera.
Yeah. That's exactly what happened.
Yeah.
And
But you're still Lisa Simpson, the voice
yes,
at
yes.
this time.
Yes,
but you're
God.
Having trouble getting on camera work.
I could get no other work.
Is it because this, which I've talked about, like this business just tends to slot you into a place and that's kind of where you're stuck?
I think so. And I think, you know, and I'm unusual. I have a funny voice. I look really young. And so even when I was, this really started to happen when I was about sort of early 30s, right?
Mm.
Even though I was chronologically old enough to play somebody's mom, I don't think they thought that I could play somebody's mom. And they also often thought of me still as Lisa Simpson. I think it was just sort of the perfect storm of some terrible circumstances. Anyway, after 22 years, I fired my agent, and then I couldn't get another agent.
What?
Yeah, because I wasn't going to go to an agency and say, sure, you can have 10% of The Simpsons, when they hadn't done any of the work.
And none of them would take you unless they could get 10%.
That's exactly right.
Yeah. Now, here's the thing about your voice. Like, if you weren't Lisa Simpson or you weren't doing a animated character, a cartoon, I would just say you're a woman with a kind of a high voice.
Yeah.
And I would put you in things and then, you know, ask you out on a date. I'm not hitting on you. I'm married. And to me, you're married.
I love you, Paul.
Yeah, exactly. Plus, there's people looking in, so I can't. Eric, look away. Stop.
Look away.
And I propose. I'm kind of a very thoughtful guy. But I also get it on how, like, they just want to slot
you. They do. It's so much easier for them, yeah. You know? And people ask me all the time, do you think it's kept you from other work? And I'm sure it has. But at the same time, I can't, if I compound that worry and put a lot more eggs in that worry basket of Lisa Simpson is keeping me from other things, then I'm hamstringing myself, I believe.
Well, how do you do that? Because I have trouble with that. And this is where my wife is great and I'm terrible. She like keeps me grounded because you talked about in an interview that I was looking at, you moved to LA on a semi-promise of a part in a TV show. It didn't come true.
Yes.
And you learned from that to build a wall around yourself to cope with the disappointment of not getting parts. How did you do that? Because it's so much rejection as talent, especially. And how do you not fixate on the negative, fixate on the rejection and all of that?
I don't know, actually. And it's not that I don't feel the rejection anymore. I just recover more quickly.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think if you're a person who cares deeply about what you do and you only have one speed, which is to give it your all if you want it, right?
Mm.
Then I don't know how you avoid the disappointment of rejection.
Right.
The best you can do is pull up your socks, you know, after 3 days instead of 7 days and then get on with it, right?
Yeah. I don't think I'm at 3 days yet. I keep going, but like this therapist I've talked to says it's like you fly with your flaps down. And he goes, somehow you, every time I see you, there's another great thing you're doing, but then there's always this other like whatever. And I'm like, yeah, I know. If I were functional, I wouldn't be a comedian. I always say if my mother hugged me two more times, I wouldn't be a performer.
Thank God she didn't do that.
That's nice of you to say.
But to sort of back to that point, actually, when I fired my agent, I couldn't get another agent, and I needed something to do. And so I had always written sort of short stories for my own self. And a friend of mine said that she was taking a writing class from a woman in the neighborhood. I lived in the San Fernando Valley at the time. And so I was like, okay. So I went to that class just so that I could do something creative and not feel like a complete waste of food. And so I, and over the course of 3 years in that class, 2 years in that class, I started to write these little vignettes about this 11-year-old girl named Lorelei. And she was really funny and had a very sort of cockeyed view of the world and was very sly and emotionally intelligent. And all of these vignettes added up to this book that HarperCollins bought and published called I, Lorelei. And the lesson from that was that I didn't need to rely on 100 other people to make me creatively satisfied and also gainfully employed. Now, I didn't make any money off the book.
Mm-hmm.
It was really beautifully reviewed and a commercial failure.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a really seminal moment for me.
Yeah. And how did you get, just as a practical matter, how did you get that sold? That's a feat in and of itself. Did you get a book agent?
I did. This writing teacher, she had a book agent. And so I went. She said, I really love this. Let me give it to them. And there were a tiny agency here in New York called Distel and Gutterich. And the guy that I had a male agent. His name was Jim. He was a really wonderful editor. I said, your talents are being wasted as an agent. I think you should be an editor, but that's just me. So he gave me some notes, and in a couple of months, we sent it out, and it sold in a week.
Wow.
Yeah, it was so fast.
That's a that's a great story.
It was really amazing.
Do you, in all of that, it's just, I'm just a little sidetracked here because I'm thinking, as you're telling me this, this is, you're one of the main characters of the seminal, one of the seminal shows on TV, and you have to get your, writing teacher in the San Fernando Valley to help you get an agent. There's something wrong with that.
It's just,
but, it does create, it is a great story. And that book maybe would not have happened.
No, it wouldn't have.
Now, is any of you Lorelai?
Oh, yeah. I, you know, Lorelai, much like Lisa Simpson, is, she's the best version of myself. You know, she, they, and the thing that those, both those characters share is a resilience that I, has taken me forever to cultivate.
Were you, I know you've talked about being anxious as a kid.
Yes.
And not quite sure. Where did that come from? Was it sort of, you know, was that nature nurture? Were your parents anxious people? Or?
No. I think it came from wanting to be in control all the time. And of course, life's not like that.
Yeah.
And I still struggle with that.
It's just how you're wired.
It just is how I'm wired.
Yeah.
I'm very...
You and I couldn't be married because we're almost exactly alike.
Yes.
We really are. Like, because my... And but this is why it works with
right,
my... My wife is like, she's as smooth as silk, roll off your back.
Yeah.
The day's going to be great
we
tomorrow.
Need that.
Look
yeah.
at what you got. Don't look at what you don't have.
Glass half full.
Yeah.
100%.
Which can be very annoying.
Totally annoying. Exactly. I totally get that too.
We should like talk every like month just to kind of
we should be less therapy
own,
for both of us.
Swim in our own shit. And do you, that anxiety, do you have more control over being, because I tend to sort of run things over in my head a lot.
Me too.
And I was a lawyer before I did this, so that's part.
That's crazy.
And I'm, yeah, and I worked on Wall Street and then I quit to be a comedian, so.
I love that you did that.
Yeah, well, not my mother or father, but yeah. I went to law school in your hometown in D.C.
Oh, you did?
And I liked living there.
Yeah.
But then I wanted to do corporate law, so I came to New York and then, you know,
How long before you quit law school and quit being a lawyer?
I was
on
for about, I was doing M&A, merger and acquisition deals. I did law for about 3 years, investment banking for two. And in the middle of that, I started making short films and writing, kind of like your book things. There was something coming out of me
yeah,
and
yeah.
I couldn't suppress it. And then I thought, well, it'll just be a hobby. But then I became, and then I met Jay Leno at a private function. And I had all these jokes written, and I didn't know what I was going to do with them, so I gave them to Jay.
Wow.
And he was like, okay, right. And he took them. So and then, like, 2 days later, my phone rang, and he called me.
That's incredible.
And when he called me, he was like, it's Jay Leno. It's Paul Mercurio there. And I thought it was my friend David who was, like, pulling a prank. And I'm like, yeah, right, David. He goes, no, Jay Leno. And then I actually said to Jay Leno, you do a lousy Jay Leno. And so then he hired me to as like a, you know, sort of a freelance writer, pay you $50 a joke. And
yeah.
And then he did one of my jokes like two nights later.
What
so
was
here's
that
a middle
like?
A middle class kid from Rhode Island, parents high school educated, doing these huge merger deals like they're on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, like household name companies.
Right.
And then this little $50 joke blew my head off my shoulders.
Of course.
It just, because I think what happened was I always loved stand up, and we got to stop talking about me right after this.
Why?
Because this is.
I love this.
And so they, that box always had comedians on that I would watch. And then I'd like go to school and I'd tell some of their jokes in the locker room. And I was kind of a cut up, whatever. But I didn't think I was going to be a comedian. And all of a sudden, out of that box came my words.
Yeah.
That had an effect on people.
Yeah.
And I think it took me a long time to figure this out. Excuse me. And I'm not even sure if I'm still right about this, but. As an advisor, a lawyer, banker, pardon me, you are an advisor. You're not really creating anything. You're facilitating something.
Mm-hmm.
And while that was fulfilling, it wasn't the same thing as creating. And then I started, to live a secret double life where I was a lawyer, investment banker by day.
Wow.
And a comedian by night. And when all the other associates were going to dinner, I was going to dive bars around New York City in my like $3,000 Brooks Brothers shirt and doing open mic. Like
so brilliant.
Like hell holes.
So good.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's so good.
Yeah.
Did you not think you would be a comedian because your parents didn't want you to be, or did
it just
you?
It just
wasn't even on the radar.
It wasn't on the radar. You know, like my father put floors in for a living. My mother, who's 91, still running her own furniture business that she started when she was pregnant with me. I don't really need you for this show because I'm just going to talk about myself. You can go now. So anyway, you come from that upbringing. They want it to be better for their kids, right? So they want you to at least go to college, maybe graduate school, so that you start thinking about, and I liked numbers in business, so I was like thinking accounting or, you know, just that. And then 30 years in the white picket fence and, you know, you retire to Florida, Arizona. Like, that's kind of the track I was on.
Right.
And then this thing bit me in the ass.
Now, were they happy for you when Jay Leno started to do your jokes? Because he's iconic. So I should think that when Jay Leno is doing your jokes, not just some dude they've never heard of, that it would actually be meaningful to them.
Yeah, I think so. But they didn't understand it. My wife was funny. When I said to her, I want to leave Wall Street to be a comedian, she goes, that better be your first joke. But no, she was really, really cool. But I think my parents and my wife said, you worked so hard. I mean, law school was really hard and I had to pay for it and do loans. Why do you want to go at that again? Because you really have to deconstruct your life. Like, I sold my apartment on the Upper West Side, sold everything I owned. I moved to a rooming house for $327 a month.
Oh my God.
And I started to live the life of a comic. Yeah, there was like stabbings before I would go on stage. A guy threw bloody napkins at
me. Jesus, Paul.
Yeah, there's like a whole thing, and I got audited by the IRS. It's a whole thing. Someday we'll do one with, anyway. So my parents didn't understand it. And then I worked on The Daily Show. I was a writer on The Daily Show for a number of years. And when we got our first Emmy Award, and I went home with the Emmy Award, and I took a picture of it with my mother. I think then she kind of thought, oh, okay, this is like... And then she would have articles up of me in the store, her furniture store. And people would come in and go, what's that guy? He works on The Daily Show. I love that show.
Yeah.
So it was through other people, through that lens, that she started to understand and or... like respect it, but it took a while.
And do you know Kevin Blyer?
Yeah, I do know Kevin.
Yeah.
Yeah. How do you know Kevin?
Because he used to work on Dennis Miller's political talk show.
Mm-hmm.
And for reasons unbeknownst to me, I was a guest on that show. You know, I used to do a panel with three people, you know, several times. And that's how I know him. Oh, He's the one who would tee me up.
Oh, cool. Mm-hmm. So do you have any goals to like write again or write more or write another book or anything like that?
You know, after I finished Lorelei, I really loved it. And there was room for there to be a sequel. And I thought about it. And then, you know, because I'm not a writer, like writers actually live to write. Like, you lived to tell that joke and you left everything to be able to do that thing.
Right.
I think writing is exactly the same. It's so hard even if you're working three jobs, your fourth job will be, I will write for 2 hours in the middle of the night.
Right.
And that's not me.
Yeah. And so do you have any aspirations to be in front of the camera or to, if you,
yeah.
Well, you have
it.
A production company.
I do.
And what do you guys have some interesting projects.
We really do. So it's called Paperclip Limited. And I co-founded it with my business partner of a long time, Ben Cornwell. And we produced a film that Michael Kelly starred in called All Square that won the Audience Award at South by Southwest last year. And that was really fun. We just wrapped a film called Gossamer Folds in Louisiana, and it's about a transgender woman of color in 1986 in a small town in the United States. Mm. And she's a wonderful dress designer. She's trying to get to New York City for the ballroom scene. Mm. And she ends up befriending this little boy who's 8 years old in the script, played by Jackson Robert Scott from It. And they're really just two misfits trying to figure out how they can sort of find a connection.
Yeah.
So he's just moved in next door with his family. His parents are getting a divorce. They're kind of ignoring him. He ends up befriending this trans woman who's living with her dad and is also trying to get out of town.
Mm.
And it's a wonderful Fox and the Hound story.
Mm.
I really love it. Alexandra Gray is the trans woman of color who's our star, and like I said, Jackson Robert Scott. I have a small part in it because I'm like Hitchcock. I like to pass through the lens.
I can't believe
every
you.
Time
you I can't believe you got the part.
You know what? I had to put in all the money.
Did you? Did you look in the mirror and go, you know what? I really see you as a voiceover person.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll give you.
Maybe.
I'll give you a shot.
Yeah, you can play Phyllis, the mean dress shop owner.
Are you trying? Is there a void that you see in Hollywood, which is a tough thing to find because there's so much content being produced with digital and everything, but is there a void in terms of the kind of content, the stories that you want to tell, that you'd like to see told, that you're trying to do with your production company?
I wouldn't, yes, as a general answer, yes. We don't actually focus on one medium. We have the podcast, obviously, Small Town Dicks. Mm. And we do films. We developed a wonderful, Paul, if you could see this art called Neocats, and it's for kids, and it's an animated, show, which is just, we've been shopping it around. I don't like to be tied to one genre, one medium per se. I like to throw a lot of spaghetti at the wall and see what sticks. And for me, it's really, is the story good? So I don't care if it's a play. I don't care if it is a podcast. Mm. I want to know, does it have wit? What's the point of difference? Why does this story need to be told? Mm. Would I stay? I'm a person who actually walks out of movies.
Really?
Yeah, all the time. If you can't entertain me in 22 minutes, I got to go.
That's hilarious.
And so,
have you always been like that?
Yeah.
Do you get bored quickly and you want, because I tend to get bored quickly and then want, not drastic change, like change careers every 2 years, but I mean, it sounds like you need to be stimulated in lots of different ways.
I do. Yeah. And I also feel like my simple criteria for a performance really well done is, would you behave that way alone in a room if you didn't know I was watching?
Yeah.
And so if I am watching something and you can't grab me in 22 minutes, dude, I got to fucking go. I got a lot of stuff to do.
I got a book to write.
Right?
I got an agent to find.
I'm just saying.
That's hilarious.
I got food to cook, I got things. And so, and the joke around the office is Yardley doesn't like anything. So when I read something that I love, like this script, Gossamer Folds, that a friend of mine brought to me, there's kind of a parade because
a parade.
It doesn't really happen.
There's pyrotechnics from the roof of the building where your office is. And were you like that when you started with The Simpsons? Because it started as an animated short, Tracy Ullman show. Did you see that short potentially being a full length show? And even then, like The Daily Show, when we started out, was different than what it ended up being when we hit our stride. Because, you're making the machine that makes the donuts and making the donuts at the same time, right?
Yes.
So, and I would imagine from someone on the inside, I'm fascinated to know, did you see it coming, turning into a full-length show? And secondly, even then, did it look like, I don't know if this thing's got legs or not?
I didn't know when we were shorts. I think, I wasn't very invested in the shorts.
Mm.
You just
looked at it as work for
money.
Yeah.
And as, I think we said in our last conversation, voiceover was never part of my plan for world domination. So I just didn't, even when I had this thing I was doing, and I didn't have a voiceover agent. That's not how I got that job. I got the job doing a tiny little play, a new play.
Is that the one you got paid $14 for?
No, it's the one that 19 people saw. And I think I got paid no dollars.
Oh, wow.
Literally no dollars. At a theater in Los Angeles called the Fountain Theater. And I'm not even kidding. Theater in Los Angeles is just very, very different than it is here in New York.
Mm.
And so in any case, one of those 19 people a year later would cast The Simpsons on the Tracy Ullman show. And she said, I know who should play Lisa Simpson. So when people ask me now, how do you get into voiceover? I'm like, I don't know. Because now you want me to solve your, calculus problem with an abacus. I can't do it.
Was it just a physical trait, the timbre of your voice? Or was there something in your personality that said, she could be this person, because you're not just doing a voice. You have to imbue a certain personality for that character.
I think both, actually. Mm. Although I was playing a girl in this play who wanted to join the army and sang Elvis Presley songs, which isn't a lot like Lisa Simpson. But I think there was an inherent moxie to that character that, although Lisa didn't really have that in the shorts, you know, she really was just a bratty foil for Bart, really, out of the gate. And then when we went to Half Hour, it was Jim Brooks who said, I want her to play the saxophone, and I want her to be a genius.
And why the saxophone?
I don't know, actually. I don't know if it's that because he loves the saxophone or he thought it was a great, interesting, out-of-the-box instrument that wasn't the violin, wasn't the piano, wasn't the flute or something.
It really is, actually, And the genius part, why? Because surrounded by...
Surrounded by those who are less agile in that arena. Yeah. And maybe it was a discussion with Matt Groening as well. Matt has always said he feels like Lisa Simpson's the only one who's going to get out. Should the Simpsons ever age out, Lisa Simpson's the only one who actually has a chance.
What about Marge? She's too tied to Homer?
Yeah, probably. She's very, very loyal, that one.
Yeah.
Marge.
And I remember my mother gave me a Bart Simpson's t-shirt when it really started to hit.
And what it did say, don't have a cow or Icaraba?
I think it said don't have a cow, and I think it was on a skateboard.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I don't really think she understood. She never really watched TV, but I think it was just everywhere.
Sure.
And knowing her, she was like at Marshall's on Christmas
Eve. You couldn't get away from it.
It was everywhere.
It was massive. It hit so big, so fast. So those first 13 episodes, because we were a mid-season replacement in January 1990, although the very first half-hour episode was The Simpsons Roasting on an Open Fire, which was December 1989. It was the Christmas episode where we got Santa's Little Helper. And so we had only 13 episodes, and I always heard that the network said, this is the dumbest fucking idea anybody has ever had, putting a cartoon on in primetime. It hasn't been done since the Flintstones. You all are high, but I don't really give a shit. You know, because it won't last.
Yeah,
it's not that big a deal. And it is James L. Brooks. We got to, you know.
And is it true because they thought it wouldn't last that James said, you can't give me notes? Generally, for people listening who don't understand the business, you do a show, the network owns the show. They want to give you notes every week on the script. Oh, maybe Bart should do this. And it can be helpful, but a lot of times not. And James, I guess, had the power to say.
Yes.
And they said, okay, we won't give you notes. But really, because they just
thought it wasn't going to last. And even let's say it went for, you know, two seasons, whoop-de-doo. It is James L. Brooks. Yeah. If you're going to trust anybody, it's that guy.
Yeah, exactly.
Mostly I think they thought it was sort of a non-starter. So.
Yeah. And did you, once it kicked in, were you surprised at how it took off so fast?
Yes. I didn't know we had that many fans. And Fox was nothing.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't have any shows.
Well, it's interesting because those animated shorts on Tracy Ullman, I think, are the equivalent to putting shorts out on digital now. It sort of builds your fan base in an organic
way. That's well said.
Really? Let me write that down. Tell my wife I said something good.
We have it on digital.
Oh, that's right.
We have a digital copy of it. We can send it to her.
Wait, Eric forgot to hit record. We got to start over.
Oh, rats.
did you... When you, in the development of Lisa over time, have you been allowed to, although I'm sure it's, you know, give feedback thoughts on what you think the character should be?
No.
No.
But I do feel an absolute moral obligation to stick up for my girl if they have her say something that she wouldn't say, or if somebody is really, really mean to her and she doesn't have a rebuttal. I really hate that. And I will fight that fight, and I might not win it, but I have to fight it.
Can you remember an example of something that they had written for her to say that you felt wasn't appropriate or right for the character?
Yes, there was very early on, I want to say, early. They had Lisa, she got a crush on a stable boy. Right. She was taking riding lessons or something. And it was so much more sexual than I was. I mean, there weren't kissing or anything, but I was like, she's 8. And maybe there are 8-year-olds who are that precocious, but that's not my 8-year-old.
Right.
That's not my girl.
Right.
And And I didn't mind that she thought he was cute, but I really, really wanted to walk it way back so that it was just, an 8-year-old who looked up to this, I think he was probably 12 or something, who knew more about horses than she did.
Oh, interesting.
And not that she found him so attractive. What was attractive about him was that he had a body of knowledge that she didn't yet have and really wanted.
Which makes sense for a character that you've made to be a genius.
Yeah.
Like that genius would be more attracted to the mind than...
Right.
And did you win that? Did you win that fight?
I did.
That's great.
Yeah.
So you do have significant input when you want to put it in there, when you want to put it out there.
They're very, very gracious about that, I will say. They will, they always listen, seemingly seriously anyway, and I'm grateful for that. Like yeah. I said, it's not, unless I really hate it. Like there was an episode, 6 or 7 years ago where Homer was really, really mean to Lisa. And I forget what the situation was. And I'm like, you can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do that. Mm. And I didn't win it in the in the room. But by the time the episode came out, which was at least 8 months later, because it takes 8 months to animate one episode, it had been considerably softened. And I think they'd given her some sort of retort. I'm like, all right, I can live with that. But you cannot hang my girl out to dry.
It's funny you say that because when I watched it and Homer's been mean to her, he's mean to everybody, obviously, but to her, and I don't want to sound sexist, but because it's a little girl, it just feels, I don't know, harsher than to the little boy.
And people love Lisa Simpson.
So then how does the show get away with it? Why does the show have him do that? Like, what are they trying to say in that?
I think
that.
The only time it's ever successful when Homer's mean to Lisa is when he then has a turn in the final act and goes, oh, shit, I fucked that up. And then comes back and says, I didn't know what I was doing. I didn't know what I was saying.
Right.
And, I really apologize. And then I think people feel like she hasn't been wronged, that obviously a lesson was learned and she hopefully comes some distance as well to see what the gap in understanding was. But there has to be a meeting of minds.
Right.
You can't leave it like that. You just can't.
Yeah. I know you've said that the for the writers on the show who are these geniuses, Lisa can be a catharsis. What about for you? Has playing that character changed you or helped you figure some things out about yourself?
Yes. I had a kind of, you were talking earlier about your parents realized, sort of came to understand your success through the eyes of other people, strangers who would walk into your mom's furniture store and go, what the hell is that? Shiny gold statue, right? And I had a sort of similar dynamic with my father in particular, who, journalists, I've heard that journalists, cops, and surgeons sort of share an intrinsic neglect of their home lives because their work is so all-consuming, right? And also have the highest rate of divorce.
Really?
Yeah, that statistic might be old, but I did read it once. Mm. And so my father, we didn't see a lot of him when I was growing up. He...
was he traveling with UPI and that kind
of
thing?
No, they stopped traveling. He quit UPI. I was born in Paris. I have an older brother who was born in London. My father was stationed in Poland and in Russia.
Mm.
And I was born in 64, so this is smack in the middle of the Cold War.
Wow.
And so they were in Poland when my mother was pregnant with me, and she went to Paris because she had an aunt and uncle who were summering there. And the Polish doctors apparently said, listen, you don't speak the language very well. And if something goes wrong, we probably can't help you as well as a Western country. You have somewhere to go. So she was like, yeah, all right, I got an aunt and uncle in Paris, so I'll go there. And then, but then after the summer, because I was born on July 3rd.
Your father was there for the birth and everything?
He came a couple days later, yeah. And then they went back to Poland. And my mother, she said, I have two babies and two hands. I'm going back to the States. Are you coming? And I think my father, he was having the time of his life. It's a fucking Cold War, dude.
Yeah.
And he's in Poland and he's in Moscow.
In the heart of it, yeah.
Yeah. And so, but they came back. Both my parents are from New York, actually.
Oh.
My father from Brooklyn, my mother from Manhattan. And so we lived with my mother's parents for about a year while my father looked for a job, and that was the Washington Post. And we moved to D.C. when I was about three. Mm. And he worked for the Washington Post until he retired. And so he just worked all the time. And he had a horse, ironically.
Really?
Yeah. And we all tried to ride for a while. That was definitely not my thing. I was always falling off the horse, you know, tumbling off his neck. And it's not my jam, dude.
Were you trying to get your dad to sort of give you approval for what you were?
I think we were all trying to, you know, if he only had a couple days off on the weekend and he was going to go ride the horse, well, then, you know, dance with the one that brung you. So we all rode, actually. My mother, my brother, myself. My brother was actually quite good.
Hmm.
But we didn't stick with it. It didn't really work out that way. And so back to your point, you know, when I became... I did this play in Washington, D.C. right out of high school.
Mm.
I hadn't gotten into college. And literally 3 days after I graduated, I got a job at this great theater in D.C. called New Playwrights Theater.
Mm-hmm.
And they were doing a sketch comedy, sort of musical comedy review. And I got the most extraordinary, like your mother would write, reviews in the Washington Post.
Mm.
And also, excuse me. Sorry, the Washington Times, I think, existed back then, and the Washington Star, certainly.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a big, like, I'm not kidding. They went on for paragraphs, and it was sort of this joke, like, oh, did your dad write that review? I'm like, no. But now he was, oh, you're Yardley Smith's father, right? And so through the eyes of other people, I think he realized, oh, shit.
Yeah.
There must be something there, right? Yeah.
So he wasn't necessarily encouraging this as you were thinking about doing it. Yeah.
He wasn't discouraging it. I think he was just sort of oblivious to it.
Was your mom more supportive?
She was. She came to every single school play, like every performance of every school play. We often provided a lot of the furniture for the school plays. They would come and, you know, take the coffee table and the couch and the chairs and she was great. And when I didn't get into college, I think they were a little worried, little like, oh, shit, oh, shit, oh, shit. What if this thing that you've had your eye on since you were five, what if that doesn't work out? I'm like, what are you talking about? Of course it's going to work out.
I'm going to get a six-picture deal from Paramount in about 2 weeks.
I mean, what?
And there's not going to be any rejection.
No.
And I'm going to write a book about a girl named Lorelai someday.
That's right.
And did you not apply to college? Or you didn't?
I did apply, but I just didn't get in because I wasn't really very interesting on paper.
Mm-hmm.
My SATs, my verbal was really high. My math was like, can the girl count? Because we are worried. This is bad. And I hadn't done anything. All I did was drama club, right? All I did was school plays. I didn't want to do anything else. So I didn't play sports. Yeah. I wasn't very shiny on paper.
Were there lots of conversations in your house about politics and the news with being, you know, your dad
no,
in the world?
No, of course not.
No.
No.
Yeah, there was just, it was just horses and.
Yeah. And then he wasn't there.
And then he wasn't there.
Yeah.
Yeah. But he came to sort of get it, you know.
And, he did. And then he was enormously proud of me.
Mm.
And, but back to sort of Lisa Simpson, I think, you know, her feeling misunderstood by her father was not, not an enormous distance from the relationship I had with my own father.
Mm. So it kind of helped you in a way.
It did. The
character and understand it.
When she shed tears, I often shed real tears in those sessions.
Yeah, you're not just doing voiceover. You're part of, you're tied to that character. You mentioned Cops, and you have this podcast that we talked about a lot on when you were here, but there was more I wanted to talk about, Small Town Dicks, which is the best name for a podcast ever. I actually was writing it down today and I wrote Small Dicks.
The abbreviation is STDs, but we can't use that. So
that's bad marketing.
Yeah, it's bad.
You can't have hats with STDs.
No. So we call our fans the Small Town Fam.
Nice.
It's pretty great. And my co-host and co-creator, Zibby Allen, came up with Small Town Fam.
Yeah. And do you tell folks a little bit, just a reminder, sort of what you guys focus on with the podcast?
So all of our cases are told by the detectives who broke the case. Mm. And Zibby and I, we're the audience. And so we ask all the questions that you would ask if you were in the room with those detectives.
Did I read right that you hear it in real time?
Yes.
Pretty much?
Yeah.
Wow.
So we used to try to do a fair amount of prep, actually. We would get the police reports ahead of time and we would know what was coming. And then that actually became sort of cumbersome. Policemen aren't actually always very organized in terms of getting you paperwork in advance. So we were like, again, okay, I got to dance with the one that brung me. So we're going to hear it right out of the gate. We'll have maybe the briefest sort of description of what the case is. Dan and Dave, who are our co-hosts and identical twin detectives, they actually vet all the cases and they vet the detectives who come on as guests if the case isn't theirs. Because they bring a credibility and an authenticity that Zibby and I could never manufacture, no matter how charming.
And they probably help the detectives tell their story, right?
Absolutely. And they can relate to them, even if they weren't actually on the case because it's not their town. They can say, oh, yeah, I had a case like that. Or, of course, I know what you're talking about in that regard.
So they're a nice bridge between you guys. And
It's the most incredible bridge. I don't think we really realized how valuable it would be until we actually got into the thick of it. And so one of the things that really fascinated Zibby and I and why we wanted to do this with Dan and Dave was when we would be with them, because we're all friends, and if Dan and Dave happened to say, and they never really would advertise that they were detectives. As they always say, people wave to firemen with all five fingers. They wave to cops with one.
That's great.
Yeah. So we really were fascinated by the fact that this big time crime was happening in small town USA, because people would insult them and say, well, oh, you're a cop in a small town. What do you do? Rescuing cats out of trees
shit?
Yeah. And what's true is with the same level of depravity and complete disregard for human life, recklessness, and cruelty, these crimes are happening everywhere just with less frequency.
Where did the interest come from in this? And then to start the podcast, like, was this born out of your particular interest in this world?
I worry about repeating myself and that your listeners will turn us off, Paul. They may have already.
They would never know. that not being able to ride a horse, that's got people crying still. I'm getting you horse riding lessons.
I really don't. I've had them. I'm good.
It's so funny. My Uncle Ralph would hang out with me a lot because my father was working all the time. So my Uncle Ralph was in a way my surrogate father. He taught me woodworking and he took me to ride a horse. And this is when they had cameras with flash cubes. And he decided he was going to take a picture of me on the horse using a flash. And the horse freaked out and bucked and threw me off. And I was like eight. I'm like, I'm good.
I'm good.
I'm good.
I'm done.
I don't think there's going to be an Italian in any Westerns anyway. So
I tried for years to love learning riding a horse, and it just was not my thing.
Yeah. But the interest.
Anyway, So I was a really good kid. I was a really good kid. I'm a rule follower. I like order. Mm. I think it's part of sort of the OCD part of me, which I think I feel as though it gets worse as I get older.
In what way? Are you like, you got to wash it?
No, not like that, actually, luckily. But if the picture is slightly crooked, I have to fix it. If the chair is not straight under the table, I have to fix it. Mm-hmm. You know, I like things.
Okay, why are you fixing my chair right now?
Come on, in their place.
Yeah, no, I understand.
And so, I'm really fascinated, and I genuinely don't understand who these people are who have no regard for that order. And society actually can't function if we don't all adhere to a certain number of rules that we hold dear. And yet, there are always people in every culture who upend those rules. And I think, for me, again, sort of back to being an anxious kid, I wanted to know that there was a force greater than me looking out for all of us, looking out for this order and able to put the train back on the tracks.
The cops.
Yeah, if something went terribly wrong.
So how is as you've delved into this, almost even directly or tangentially, you're exploring sort of the psychology behind what happens and why. What have you discovered, and what effect have those discoveries had on you?
I've discovered that people really don't know how to deal with adversity.
You mean vis-a-vis the criminals?
Yeah. And so, whereas I often feel like I overreact to things, that maybe I don't deal with adversity so well, then you look at somebody who really, really doesn't know how to deal with adversity, who, when his girlfriend breaks up with him, he takes a baseball bat and bashes her head in. Mm. You know, that's such a huge leap. And why? And what happened there?
Do you find it's rooted in pretty much all of these people's childhoods and sort of damaged goods, or some are just born and wired that way?
I think some probably are born and wired that way. I think it's, you know, we don't always get a full psychological picture. Mm. There's often a lot of drugs involved. That certainly is a massive factor. Mm. But I think also not knowing and not understanding how you go from 0 to 100 in a nanosecond and do something that will alter your life horribly without regard for the consequences is so anathema to me.
Yeah.
And I really don't get it.
And it's probably something that you can't really ever get your head around because it's so foreign to.
Exactly.
Yeah. And how do the cops deal with that? I've always wondered how, you know, these cops that deal with the most gruesome aspect of that world. I mean, PTSD, I don't know.
They all say they put it in a box. And they also all say that the box doesn't stay locked forever. Mm. And so there's tremendous value in being able to debrief with your colleagues. There's a lot of gallows humor that goes into it.
Oh, yeah.
And so back to the thing, like, you know, what we were saying about Dan and Dave being able to relate to our guests on a level that Zibby and I will never be able to relate. Mm. I think it puts our guests at ease, like, well, you know what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah, right.
Even if Zibby and I are just agog at what they had to see, what they had to do, what it took to get all the pieces to fall into place perfectly so that justice was served. There's a shorthand between those guys.
So this is a pretty involved podcast. I mean, mine, I just, you know, one-on-one talking to people, but you've got multiple people, plus you're sort of structuring story and all of that. Did your producing skills from sort of, did you glean producing skills just from being on The Simpsons all these years that you're using here? Or sort of how did you get the skills to do that? Or are you learning on your feet as a producer doing the podcast?
I learned a lot on my feet, and I'm a pretty good student, even though I couldn't get into college.
Math,
I suck at math. Mm. Like, there are certain equations I actually have to count on my fingers, like 8 and 5, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, every single time. I feel like I was just absent that day from first grade where they were doing 8 and 5 and like 7 and 6, even though that's probably the same number and I never remember it. But Zibby, we both edit on paper, and then we pass it off to two really phenomenal editors who do it in Pro Tools, right? Yeah. Make all the cuts and things. Yeah. And so Zibby does the macro. She takes the episode that's probably 2 hours long and shapes it down to whatever it'll be, usually about an hour. And then I'm what I call the flea comb, and I go I'm very, as I said, I'm very detail oriented, but I'm also a pretty good editor. Like, I'm really good at grammar. So I'm good at sentence structure. And I think that skill also has helped me. I feel like I'm good at, I know what you're trying to say, and I can help you get there without putting words into your mouth.
Well, yeah, and making it feel like it's yours. Yeah,
yeah, I don't want it to be mine. Yeah. I want it to be yours. But let me help you clear it up, because as a listener, I can tell you what I know what you mean, and here's what I got. Mm. So let's marry those two things so we get what you meant.
That's great. I'm doing this one-man show, and you have a phrase that is a key phrase in my one-man show. It's a show where I bring audience members on stage and they tell stories.
Harrowing.
They tell stories from their lives.
Really?
Yeah.
Can we do that?
Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah. I'm doing a show Wednesday night. If you're here, you can come. And it's the most incredible, just real life stories.
Because like, everybody has a story.
And that's what I was getting to. You say, in terms of where we go, I feel like, this is your quote, everybody has a story. Everybody feels like their story isn't that interesting and every one of them is wrong. And that's exactly what I found and what I say in my show. And sometimes I get asked, people say, well, those people plants. I'm like, no, like, well, how does it work out? I go, well, you just ask questions, you peel back the onion and you listen. Don't try to go for funny all the time, because then you're going to suppress the realness of it. The funny will find itself organically. And then you have, like, we had this one couple, they were 70 years old. One was 68, one was 70. They just met, they're married a year, everybody claps. I'm like, how did you meet? The woman goes, spankme.com. I'm like, yeah, right. Everybody starts laughing. They go, no, we're serious. And the guy says, yeah, we have an open relationship. And what did that mean? And well, you know, the woman says, I was looking for a dom. He was looking for a sub. We met on this site. We got together. We role played. We said, the three of you have the face of everybody in the audience. Everybody's leaning forward now. And we met and we realized we belonged together. And we struck up a relationship and we fell in love and we got married and we're here on our honeymoon. And
that
the place went crazy.
It's incredible.
And the guy said he called it sexual power exchange, meaning you give up your power to somebody and you get something from that. And then the woman went just like this. She went, oh, she goes, every woman should try it once. I go, why? She goes, because I have a very important job where I have to be in control of myself, the job and things in life. To give up power to somebody else where they control is so freeing. It just relaxes you.
It's also incredibly gracious of them to accept that responsibility for you.
So I'm learning like a lot about lifestyles that, you know, you might make a joke about or whatever. And by the way, the button to this, they literally look like your grandmother and grandfather.
That is hilarious.
It's not like some guy who walks in all leather. He had like L.L. Bean shoes on and a button-down plaid. I swear to God. They look like they own an antique shop.
That is brilliant.
Oh, by the way, she had just come out as bi, too. At 70. Yeah, there you go.
There you have it.
I'm helping people find themselves.
Wow, you're helping.
But this everybody has a story. Was that something going in that you wanted to, you knew, or is this something coming out of the podcast that you've come to realize? Like, in terms
I always knew it. I'm eternally fascinated by who people are.
Yeah.
How they do what they do and why they do it.
Yeah.
I could sit here and talk to you all day about you.
Hmm. Well, let's.
Because
no, just kidding. Yeah.
I just find it so extraordinary.
Mm.
How do people, as human beings, each one has our own path. How do you find your way?
Mm. Yeah, it's true. And I think some people, you know, they don't. Like, you know, I thought I had found my way and then this other thing happened.
Exactly.
Right? So it's this ever-evolving thing. Even at 68, 70, the woman realized that she's bisexual. Like, and I just, that really struck a chord with me when I saw that, and I couldn't agree more. And, you know, some of the stories can be outrageous like that, and some a little less so, but nonetheless, there's something everybody, and especially like in big cities like LA, New York, you can be so myopic and sort of, you know, everybody's nameless and faceless.
Yes.
I think, you know, there's a really interesting, and I've listened to the podcast, it's great, and everybody should listen to it, because it's not just hearing these stories and, oh, they're kind of cool and whatever. There's like a, you peel back the onion and you get the listener to start thinking about like, well, why and what was going on with that person. And you really become invested in the guys who are the women that are on the show
I'm
that
so
week.
I'm so glad to
yeah,
say that.
It's really
we
great.
Really were, for me, and I'm sure for Zibby too, we're very interested in the human experience.
Mm.
You know, the crime is almost...
It's a vehicle.
It's the catalyst,
it's,
right?
Yeah.
And then it brings all these disparate human beings together, and you get, hopefully, a really fruitful outcome.
Yeah. Well, where can people hear the podcast?
Everywhere you like to listen. iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Spotify, you know.
I could probably listen to while I'm on my horse.
You could do it on your horse.
You should do an episode where Lisa gets on a horse and then she falls off the horse.
I think we've done that seven or eight times.
Of course.
You know, she always wants a pony.
Oh, right.
Oh, yeah.
That's right.
Always.
That's right.
For sure.
My mother would have always promised me a pony and never came through. She bribed me when I moved once. We're going to move to another house. I'm like, I don't want to move. She's like, well, we're going to move because there's like the third move. I was like 13. She goes, I have 12 or whatever. She goes, there's a lot of land. We're going to get a pony. I'll get a pony. So then we moved in, and like a couple of weeks later, I go, can I get a pony? She goes, I'm not getting you a pony. You know, who's going to take care of the pony? I'm like, who reneges on a pony deal to a son?
That's pretty big. That's not something you're going to forget.
Yeah, that's a hard-ass negotiator.
That's not like a goldfish.
Exactly.
Reneging on the goldfish.
I can't look at anything. Westerns, I start crying if I see horses. Anyway, I'm so glad we did this again.
Me too.
It's wonderful.
Thank you.
And it's Small Town Dicks everywhere. You can see it. I almost said Small Dicks again. I got a problem. And, of course, The Simpsons. And you've got some great projects coming out of your production company. Very lovely to see you again.
Thank you,
likewise. Well, to meet you in person for the first time.
Same.
Thank you. Yardley Smith, everybody.
Can I tell you a quick story about Tango?
No, we don't have time. No, I'm kidding. Yeah, go ahead.
What you were saying about that woman saying every woman should try giving up control because she has this big job. Mm. So I have structured my life for many years as being always in charge, right? Mm. I sit at the top of my pyramid. Mm. And several years ago, I took tango lessons. And I took private lessons. And I always people say, what would you do if you were an actress? And I would be a competitive ballroom dancer.
That's awesome.
Mm-hmm. I would love that. And so I took these tango lessons. And my tango teacher, after the first, 20 minutes, dropped his arms, stood back, held me at arm's length and said, Yardley, the dance doesn't work if we both lead. And I was like, oh. And literally for the next 3 weeks, he worked on breaking me like a horse so that and he would have me dance with my eyes closed so that I couldn't anticipate what he was going to do. And it was such a lesson in grace and surrender. And trust.
And lack of control, which you talk about your whole life.
Which was terrifying, right? And at the end of the day, though, what that woman was talking about in the story on stage was there is such joy in being looked after, no matter what the circumstance.
And you're better at that today than you were.
I am.
Yeah.
And I never forgot it.
Has that made you a better manager?
Yes.
Because when you manage and you micromanage, it's too much. You have to trust the people you
hire, like,
right?
Yeah, like Lenny squeezing the mouse too tightly in Of Mice and Men.
Yes.
You know, you'll choke it and you'll kill it.
Right.
And so you do, while I'm really proud of how high I set the bar in all things I do, There are times when I have to realize, okay, I touched the bar, I don't have to swing from it.
Yeah.
And so...
How has that need for control affected your personal relationships with
men? It's hard.
You're divorced and right.
Twice.
Yeah. And did that contribute to that?
Yes. I think it contributed as much also to the partners I chose who would allow me to be in control. And then I think, you know, for women in particular, there's this kind of double-edged sword where you're like, fuck you, I'm going to be in control. And then why aren't you taking care of me? And the poor man is just like, I don't know what the hell you want, lady.
Yeah.
And so I at least recognize that in myself. It's not something I've mastered, but I really, really want to be aware of it because it's so unfair.
Yeah, my mother's like that to this day. And I think if my mother weren't my brother and I, there's a good chance I would have taken over that store and run it. But
yeah.
You're always a child in your parents' eyes. Excuse me. But in my mother's case, always about control. And she never figured out how to back off on that, you know. And, you know, that's how she's wired. What are you going to do?
But it's good that you kind of.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah.
I mean, and my wife helps me with that. But it's great that you seem to kind of at least acknowledge it and you're aware of it and you're working on it. And we're all a work in progress anyway.
Exactly. So, that's at least 15% of the battle.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say half. But.
Yeah, no. There's 10% of just figuring out 8 plus 5. That's 10% of your
record
right there. What's 7 plus 6? Come on.
13.
There you go. That was an easy trick question. Yardley Smith, if you want to learn how to ride a horse or count, don't call her. But if you want to... see her great work, hear her great work, Small Town Dicks, Lisa Simpson on The Simpsons, and so great to have you.
Thank you. Really, really a pleasure.
All right, there you go. That was Yardley Smith, and really great to have her on again. Thanks for checking out the show. Leave some nice comments on iTunes if you don't mind, and we'll catch up with you next week, everybody.